ABC Radio Australia.
Health and the quality of diets around the world have been put under the microscope in a new global study, and it's found a worrying growth pattern in the Pacific where children and adolescents have large gains in weight without accompanying gains in height. The study looked at the growth trends in 5 to 19-year-olds using their height and weight and found that Solomon Islands and PNG young men were among the shortest in the world, while Pacific Islanders are also the heaviest. One health expert says these factors create a, quote, double whammy of risk because these issues can lead to poor health outcomes for people as adults. Professor Susan Sawyer is the Director of Adolescent Health at the Royal Children's Hospital here in Melbourne, and she spoke to Talia Olatia about the study.
Our initial concerns about stunting, so people who are very short and underweight, are not just in terms of mortality risks when they are young, but because they signal much higher risks for non-communicable diseases as adults. And so we recognise that there are long-term implications of people being short, and this includes greater risks for obesity in older age as well. And I need to have a recognition of a conflict of interest here. I'm a tall woman, and that, you know, height is good in terms of social status in most countries, that both men and women who are taller particularly are known to be more successful in their careers. But from a health perspective, the concern is that shorter heights, lower heights, are associated with poorer longer-term health outcomes.
And from the data that was collected in a Pacific context, what stood out to you?
What was particularly concerning about the Pacific region was that it was in many Pacific countries that not only did we have men who were, for example, the shortest, so in particular in PNG and the Solomons and in Laos, but also we had populations who were the heaviest. So in a sense, we were seeing that there was a double whammy, in a sense, of risk here, that they were both short and also over their healthiest weights by a long shot.
How can you be, like, across the Pacific, be on either sides of those spectrums and not necessarily in the good ways?
Yeah, well, one of the challenges for the Pacific is that we know that there are many countries in the Pacific where very high rates of stunting are still prevalent in under five-year-old children. So we know that that of itself is likely to contribute then to overweight and obesity as children mature. But I think what these data really are telling us is that we are needing to take a broader view, that when we think of interventions in the nutritional landscape, in thinking about growth, we've tended to think solely in terms of nutritional interventions in very young children. And these data, I think, are telling us that we need to take a broader view. You know, obviously the Pacific has been very aware of rising rates of obesity, and we really are needing to think about what's increasingly being referred to as double duty interventions, you know, interventions that are both able to respond to undernutrition and overnutrition risks. I think the opportunities for countries is really thinking about how does every country become a Goldilocks country, in a sense, where their nutritional environment, where their physical environment and where their social environments are ones that are neither too little nor too much, but are just right. Because one of the risks is that countries that are failing to pivot in their nutritional policies risk then ending up doing more harm than good.
And when it comes to low socioeconomic countries, what role does food security play when it comes to the kind of food that people are eating?
Food security and food insecurity is an incredibly important part of this. In many parts of the world, healthy food that is grown at home in gardens can be the healthiest sorts of food that is available. But when we move to more urban environments, and particularly in Pacific regions where there are challenges in terms of access to healthy foods in terms of cost, then often the healthiest foods are the most expensive foods. As many more people are growing up in cities and away from where food is grown, I certainly certainly think that there is tremendous value in ensuring that children who are growing up are really becoming nutritionally literate. But that is different to framing food choices purely at an individual level. And what we know about socioeconomic status tells us that for many people, they cannot afford to make healthy choices because typically the cheapest food is often the most unhealthy food. And so we also need to be recognizing the importance of economic decisions as ones that are framing food choice, as well as the notion of food insecurity. So I think that this is where, at a policy level, the investment in taxation drivers that try and make healthier food cheaper is a way of supporting healthier decision-making for families who are otherwise going to be much more likely to be forced to be making unhealthy decisions about food for their children, whether they're wanting to make those choices or not.
I think you already touched on this, but finally, what would you like to see this data used for?
One of the key aspects of this paper is that for many countries, indeed the majority of countries, is that children who had healthy growth patterns at the entry into this study at the age of five did continue to have healthy patterns then across older childhood and adolescence. But the particular interest in this study is that change happens. And so we cannot have this set and forget policy, which I think is too often the case, where people are really ignoring what is then happening in older childhood and adolescence. And in this particular paper, it is the exceptions where, for example, weight has been and height, children are growing well in the first 5 years of life, but then falter as they enter into older childhood and adolescence, or the reverse, that children who were doing poorly in the first 5 years of life then improved as they matured. And understanding whether in those countries there were specific interventions that had taken place, whether that's from a policy perspective, I think is the really important research question to come out of this work. At a practical level, the most important thing, though, is recognising that we need to be thinking about double duty interventions that are both taking into account the risks of underweight at one time in the life course and overweight at another time, and appreciating that there is a huge amount of growth and development that takes place in the first, indeed, 24 years of life. We see doubling in the rate of obesity between 15 and 25, for example. And so we really need to be thinking about a set of policies that are focused on a broader range than just simply under five-year-olds, as important as under five-year-old growth is.
That was Professor Susan Sawyer, Director of Adolescent Health at the Royal Children's Hospital here in Melbourne, talking to Talia Oletia. She's written a reaction to this global study for The Lancet. It's called Global Growth Trends in School-Age Children and Adolescents. Meanwhile, a new report warning that COVID-19 is threatening to spark a food crisis in the Asia-Pacific region. It suggests that the pandemic is exacerbating threats to food security that has already existed and warns that it will have long-term implications, including on the kind of long-term health outcomes that we had just heard about. The research was carried out by scientists from Australia's leading scientific organisation, CSIRO, but released by the Australian Government's Specialist Agricultural Research for Development Agency. Its CEO, Professor Andrew Campbell, says there are various scenarios that could play out.
It could take the form of steep increases in prices or shortages or both, shortages of key, particularly higher quality, more nutritious foods. And those impacts are likely to fall disproportionately on women and girls and the poorest of the poor. So they're unlikely to be evenly distributed. Obviously, with food insecurity, you get longer term health impacts, and they feed into much greater costs and burdens on economies with increasing burdens of disease and malnutrition and micronutrient deficiency and other health problems associated with food insecurity. And at its worst, food insecurity feeds into national security issues because it's more likely to precipitate significant movements of people.
But he says it's not all bad news. He says possible solutions do exist but would need to be extended.
Some of the social protection measures that have been implemented by countries could be, with relatively minor changes, could be dramatically improved from a food security point of view. So if they paid more attention to food production issues as part of social protection measures, that could make a significant difference. There's been some very innovative responses using digital platforms, smartphones, social media and so on to get better connections between producers and consumers to shorten supply chains. And again, there's a lot can be learned from those experiences and potentially implemented more broadly.
Professor Andrew Campbell, CEO of the Australian Government's Specialist Agricultural Research for Development Agency, ACR.